And so for the non-Native organizations or solidarity support organizations, I think that a lot of the work that can be done can be less, I mean, and certainly there is a place for this too, for like education and actions, but I think it's also about being ready for when the state, you know, decides that it's going to lay down an invasion again, or you know, I mean, that those kinds of things, and that I think that's equally important. And again, it's like a different frame of mind. You're being organized. You're getting, you know, you're making sure that there are cars on the road. And what happened in Gunasadage last year was very, very serious. You know, it was a very, very serious situation, and it was. It showed a tremendous resilience and strength of that community to stand up, you know, and even still today, to function essentially by having booted out their Indian Act chief. You know, I mean, that's like, that's a huge thing. It's a huge thing to have a situation where, you know, it's like a no-go zone for the Canadian police or you know, that kind of thing. And having the ability to respond to that by way of, you know, providing them with radio communications, by having cars that can bring people from Montreal. And it's different than, again, you know, getting the posters together and you know, going through those kinds of steps. But it's very, very, it's very important. And I guess the other thing that I kind of want to say on that, and I actually have props, is the question of economics, right? I mean, you hear about Gunasadage and you hear like how the high school is closed down, and you hear how the Elders Lodge comes to the end of the month and doesn't have enough food to feed everybody. And I mean, these are not by coincidence. These are like specific tactics, tools being employed by the Canadian government to essentially starve them out, to cause such hardship that there is a capitulation, that there's such pressure brought to bear on the community that they are unable to mount a resistance. And so, you know, it may be a lot less glamorous. It may be, I don't know, sometimes seen as boring. But the question of getting money to these communities is a big, big, big deal. I mean, people are poor. There's problems with, you know, like feeding families, and beyond that, you know, getting the things that are needed in terms of, you know, feeding people when, you know, when instances of like high tension flare up. And one thing I want to say, and I think it's, especially within the Mohawk Nation, it's sort of an interesting dynamic, is that there is a lot that of resources that Mohawks have at their disposal, right? I mean, I mentioned the fish in Tyendinaga. A lot of times the courts try to say that Indigenous rights or Indian rights extend, you know, to these kinds of things only for personal or ceremonial purposes. So you can have your fish, you can, you know, share it with your grandmother, maybe you can, you know, have a community gathering, but God forbid you should ever try to sell any of it, develop a resource, you know, actually have any kind of economic infrastructure that operates on your own terms. Heaven forbid that should happen, right? And the other thing that is currently a resource is smokes, cigarettes. These, every time one of these gets sold, there is $16 that doesn't go to the federal government in taxes. $16. This is a Tyendinaga brand, Tyendinaga Mohawk Tobacco Products. Right now, best estimates are it is costing the government $1 million a month in its sales. Okay? I want to say here, put your resistance where your lips are, and I'm serious. Like, anyone who is a smoker in Montreal, anywhere, should be smoking native-made cigarettes that are tax-free. Because not only are you costing the government, you are generating income for this community. I'll tell you what this supports. These cigarettes here in Tyendinaga, when they are sold, it supports a weekly food program to upwards of 100 families that is based on the traditional harvesting cycle, right? So it's the venison, it's the ducks, it's the fish, it's the strawberries, it's the maple syrup. I mean, number one, that's food on people's on tables that might not otherwise be there. Number two, it's addressing the health and the specific dietary needs of Aboriginal people who have undergone such huge lifestyle and dietary changes that you have the soaring diabetes rates, you have all this like ill health within the communities and within the children as well. So this tackles that because it's kind of ironic talking about health, but yeah, these are still mostly the non-native. And then the final thing I want to say about the food program is that you know, and a lot of people will say that it's culturally and it's spiritually significant, right? I mean, this is what people's ancestors have lived off of, and it's important. I mean, it's like a connection to the earth. It's a connection to you know, all things past. It's the proper way, you know. Things are harvested with respect, with care. It's a community initiative. It's about, you know, people helping each other. And that's I think that's a pretty fundamental thing. Other things that these support is equipment. We have in Tainanega now the entire community on radio communication. So that, you know, when the OPP attempt to drive through, there's someone, you know, it's someone at every sort of extremity all throughout the middle, either in houses, in stores, in cars, so that people are able to respond. And on a everyday, daily basis, defend the sovereignty, defend the jurisdiction of the territory. And along with that, all the other equipment that might be deemed necessary by people based on what they see coming from the state. And finally, these are used to fund the building of community meeting houses, you know, places of recreation, places of government, places of gathering that otherwise don't exist. I mean, in Tainanega, you want to have a meeting, you have to go to the band council and ask for use of the community center, and maybe you get the fees waived, maybe you don't. That community center is built on the land where the original longhouse, the place of government, the very essence of Haudenosaunee Mohawk people was burnt down. You know, people still call it the council house to remind that's what it was, that's what it is. And of course the band council is putting big, like big block letters on the front, Mohawk Community Center, to try to discourage that, to try to you know, keep that from reemerging. But this summer it will. And the final thing, there was one other thing I wanted to say. Let's see if I can remember. Yeah, so just, but around that, like, it seems to me that there is sometimes a tendency to, when we're talking about solidarity, there's like a tendency to, I don't know if this would be the right word, but like sort of Puritan politics, you know, like you don't want to get your feet dirty, you don't want to, like, cigarettes, they're not good for you, like, and I think that number one, I would say that with respect to that, like, you know, these go for $25, 200 plus cigarettes for $25, that's a big deal to a poor person. Like, you know, people smoke, it's not going out of style, like, and the majority of poor people, they smoke too, you know? And like the ability even to, not just to sell them, but to take them into organizing in the cities and use them. Like, there's nothing wrong with developing economic relationships. I think we tend to shy away from that because, you know, economic, capitalism, you know, we don't want to touch that. But in reality, there's a lot that can be developed there. You know, I mean, in Toronto, they're talking about, with OCAP, they're organizing with the taxi drivers in the city. And there's talk about, you know, having developing relationships where these are offered within the communities to be sold, to pool money for the legal defenses when they're getting harassed, ticketed by the police. I mean, there's ways that these things can be used. And when we initially started going into this, and it's only been about 8 months that we've ever been involved in the smoke business at all, But we were going into it, one, with the sense of, you know, this is cool. Like, let's keep the tax from the government. Let's keep that, you know, why give them the money they're just going to use to fight us anyway, right? And two, let's raise some money to put up the longhouse, to, you know, do this sort of thing. But what has also developed, which is was totally unexpected and not foreseen, is those economic relationships. And they bring you across people that you might not otherwise have the opportunity to talk to. And then I'm talking even within the community, like different, I don't want to say factions because that's too strong, but different, like people from different families in the communities who might not otherwise, you know, cross paths that often. And I think that's I mean, that's a huge deal. My husband is like a insane CNN watcher, and they were doing this one thing where they were talking about how the United States Army had totally, everyone knows, underestimated the strength, the size, the everything of the resistance. And the one thing that they were saying, and perhaps a rather particularly candid moment, was that the networks that existed were so much more complex and comprehensive than they had ever imagined. So, for instance, they had two people with very different religious backgrounds who still managed to have a tie in some other way. And I think that economic portion is important because we all need money. We need money to survive. We need money for the fights. And that shouldn't be overlooked as something that is, you know, not unpure politically or is, you know, not as glamorous as a thing on the TV after a big action or something like that. And the final thing I just want to say in terms of solidarity and what people's... sorry, I just left something else. But anyway, maybe we'll talk about it after. But the final thing I just want to say about solidarity and the potential roles that people can take, and again, this, to my mind, goes back to Gunas Adage. You know, in the end, that situation remains unresolved. It is ongoing. But at the same time, it is also, at this point, as much as a community can be when it's under such a huge amount of stress, relatively peaceful, relatively calm, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, this time last year, I don't know that we would be necessarily sitting here because that was when everything was going down there. And it was extended at that time. The request, the offer, I don't know, I guess it would be a request for people to come and stand on the lines with folks in Gunas Adage. And, you know, that I think is always, because of the nature of the relationship between indigenous communities and the Canadian state, that these incidences are going to flare up. And I think it's incumbent on non-Native people who are aware of what's going on and who are concerned and wanting to do something to internally within themselves assess what their limitations are and when that call is made, you know, is that something that they would be prepared to do? And I think that's an important question that each and every one of us needs to ask. Because I can tell you in Tainanega, right now, my partner was supposed to be here today, and he isn't because in the last 2 weeks, there's been a number of instances, both with training exercises by the Canadian military and helicopters and RCMP that have been, had to be forced off the community trying to, who knows what, you know, reconnaissance, training, I don't know what, you know, and just that there is a somewhat higher level of alertness right now. And, you know, if the shit were to hit the fan there, I couldn't say that there would necessarily be like an email that would go out that would be inviting people to, you know, to come or this or that, but that the expectation would be that people who are aware, would just come, and that would be the invitation, and you know, it doesn't really need to be said, you know. And I think that was really the same in Gunas Adage, and I think a lot was learned from that, and that there was great strides in terms of relationships and solidifying networks and you know, a basis of trust that is not always so easy to come by. So I think I'll leave it at that.